Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is CW Capital Asset Management against Chicago Properties. Mr. Cross.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Cross.
Don't touch the microphone. If you want the podium higher, do not touch the microphone. If you want the podium higher, there's a switch on your right-hand side.
Oh, I'm fine with the height. I just wanted to make sure you could hear me. I apologize. My name is Greg Cross on behalf of the Appellant Trust. It's a pleasure to be in front of you this morning. The facts are relatively straightforward in this matter, and they're not in dispute. The trust that I represent holds a loan that is secured by a standalone Blockbuster. That Blockbuster in 05 and 06.
Counsel, you've already said one of the big problems in this case. You say the trust that I represent. As far as I can figure out, you don't represent the trust or even the trustee. You represent CW Capital Asset Management, which is a mortgage servicer.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the initial question in this case is why the trustee is not a party.
The trustee was disclosed as the real party in interest. The special service.
Look, counsel, the way Rule 17 works is the real party in interest isn't disclosed. The real party in interest has to be the litigant. The case shall be brought in the name of the real party in interest, not somebody else. If General Motors Corporation decides that Phil Smith should litigate on its behalf, an affidavit from General Motors saying we've authorized Phil Smith to litigate on our behalf won't do. It still has to be General Motors, has to be the litigant.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do not
I'm glad you think my understanding of the rules is correct.
I don't disagree with that. However, the complaint in this action was styled in the name of the trustee.
No, it was not. The complaint in this litigation says the plaintiff is CW Capital as servicer for the trustee. It does not name the trustee as a plaintiff. There's only one plaintiff in this litigation, and it's CW Capital. That's the problem. Why would you deal with my question, which is why the bank didn't sue itself?
Because the bank delegated the authority to sue to CW Capital. And, Your Honor, with respect to the disclosure of the plaintiff, the diversity analysis that's contained in the complaint ties to the trustee.
Look. Forget about the trustee. Is the servicer a real party in interest rather than just, you know, a lawyer, an agent? That's what you have to show.
The servicer has delegated authority to sue in the name of the trustee on behalf of the trust.
You're not dealing with Judge Posner's question or mine, right? You think about questions, the legal question, or my hypothetical, which is the factual. Is it permissible under Rule 17 for the real party in interest to sign a letter saying we deputize someone else to sue on our behalf because, you know, they're specialists in bringing suits and we tell them to sue on our behalf? Does that make the person who's suing on behalf of the real party in interest itself a real party in interest? That's the legal question.
I believe that it could, and in the context of security.
Look, what you should focus on is the contract between the servicer and the trustee to see what kind of authority the servicer has. So if you hire a lawyer, he's your agent, but you can fire him and so get rid of him and so forth. But services, I understand it, often have a much greater interest in the litigation than a mere agent would have. This is especially true. Also, one thing I wasn't clear about from the servicer agreement, is the servicer servicing a package of mortgages or just a single mortgage?
A package of mortgages. Let me back up and talk directly about the trust instrument. So this instrument's governed by a pooling and servicing agreement. Section 3 of the pooling.
Now, how many mortgages? Is this one of the, you know, modern mortgage-backed securities or
commercial mortgage-backed securities?
Pardon?
Commercial mortgage-backed securities. And I'm not.
Yes, I understand. But is there a package of a package? How many mortgages is this servicer responsible for under its contract?
I do not know the precise answer. Customarily, it's approximately $1 billion.
Actually, so this is one of the this is one of the typical mortgage-backed security. Yes, hundreds of millions or $1 billion. So what you ought to be pointing out is that when a servicer is responsible for multiple mortgages, he has much more than an agent's responsibility, a standard agent's responsibility, because he has to balance the interests of the different mortgagees and or different bondholders. Is that so? Is that the nature of his responsibility?
That's accurate. And beyond that point, the only party authorized to sue under the trust document is the special servicer bringing an action on behalf of the trustee. That power is specifically delegated to the trustee in the case of a defaulted loan. Once the loan is transferred to special servicing, this is the special servicer bringing the action.
Why does that matter? Take this suggestion brought up earlier by Judge Posner. Suppose the bank signs a contract naming you as the agent, saying only the law firm of X and Y LLC can sue on our behalf. Would that make the law firm the right plaintiff in any case where the law firm is representing the bank?
It depends upon the nature of the question. For diversity purposes and measuring if the court has jurisdiction, the courts have uniformly found that the trustee is the party to disclose for diversity purposes. In terms of who has actual authority to file the suit on behalf of the trustee, you have to look at the document. The document says that the special servicer is supposed to provide it.
I obviously am not being clear. I'm not asking whether, as a matter of contract law, such a contract makes the agent the right person to sue. Right? If A contracts with B that B will sue on his behalf, then as a matter of contract, B is supposed to sue. I'm asking for purposes of Rule 17. Is that permissible? The point of Rule 17, I had thought, was to say that that kind of contract is not enforceable. Indeed, it's prohibited. That the suit must be in the name of the real party in interest, no matter who the real party in interest wants to sue on its behalf.
Correct. And I want to come back to the actual...
I continue to be pleased that you think my legal understanding is correct.
You ought to be focusing on the language of the servicing agreement, right?
Right, the language of the
master servicer says you have full power and authority acting alone to do or cause to be done any and all things. You want to distinguish that from just the ordinary hiring of an agent or a lawyer, right? I mean, this is a transfer of basic authority for the administration of the mortgages, not just for the suing on
it. And that's right. And in the case of a specialty service loan, it's a complete transfer. And in fact, the trustee is obligated to give an affidavit supporting the action that the special servicer wants to take, because the complete authority under the instrument is delegated to the special servicer. And in this circumstance, while the special servicer's name appears on the complaint, the trustee's identity was fully disclosed.
Yeah, well, that disclosure is
completely irrelevant. Let me ask the question in still a different way. There's a case that neither side has discussed. It's Sprint Communications against APCC Services, in which the Supreme Court held, though by a vote of 5-4, that it is permissible to assign a case for collection, and that the assignee is then the real party in interest and has standing to sue, even though the assignee is going to turn all the money over to the assignor. And I would think that the technical correct question in this case, although, as I say, one that neither side has addressed, is whether this underlying service agreement amounts to an assignment for the purpose of collection within the meaning of Sprint Communications. But since neither side has discussed Sprint Communications, it's kind of hard to make that judgment. None of the stuff in the brief seems to be responsive to what the Supreme Court's opinion in Sprint Communications said was required for this kind of thing.
Well, let's go with that for a minute. If that's the case, clearly the special servicer would be the real party in interest and have authority to sue this, and the trial judge's decision would be wrong. If you stop short of that and concluded that disclosure was adequate, which is where the briefs sit, the trial court was wrong. The trustee was disclosed, and that picked up on all of the reported decisions thus far, which say that the proper way to caption these.
Look, let's move on to the merits. We're not getting over the disclosure. Look, I understand your Rule 17 argument. I don't, but I don't understand your argument on the merits. I don't get that. So Blockbuster, of course, is in terrible shape, doesn't want to pay its rent, so there's a settlement. And why isn't that settlement action by the landlord in the ordinary course, you know, reasonable action as the mortgage agreement explains, right?
On the SNDA.
So, except to the extent mortgager is acting in the ordinary course of business and in a commercially reasonable manner, et cetera, he has, you know, he shan't do these various things, right?
Right.
But given this exception and the tenant's default, Blockbuster's default, what is improper about what the landlord did?
The mortgagee was precluded from taking advance payment of rent, from terminating the lease without consent. That was acknowledged by the mortgagee.
I don't understand. What force do you give to acting in the ordinary course of business in a commercially reasonable manner? You're a landlord, you have a tenant, can't pay, and so on. What are you supposed to do? Why aren't you supposed to try to work out some settlement so that you're not completely stiffed by the tenant?
No.
Because
you are disposing of the lender's collateral. In a commercial real estate lending situation, you're looking to two things.
I don't understand what you mean by disposing of the collateral. The collateral is the building. And here you have a tenant, Blockbuster, which is leaving. It's going to either pay the rent, pay a settlement, or just get out. And you're going to have an empty building. Now, the empty building is less valuable, you know, than a building with a nice tenant who pays rent. But that wasn't in the cards. You weren't going to have Blockbuster there.
It's a mistake to conclude that the collateral is just the building. There's an assignment of the rents and leases, and in a commercial setting, you're lending against the cash flow of the property.
But Blockbuster isn't paying, so
then
how are you going to...
Then the remedy...
You have to show, it seems to me, that the landlord settled with Blockbuster at some unreasonable a level, right?
No.
Well, what do you have? What
There's
do,
a full
what
assignment.
You
there was,
wanted to see the landlord do here?
And I wanted to see the landlord enforce the terms of the lease. They could pay. They had a contractual lease that obligated them to pay an additional $480,000.
Well, why would if the landlord had could have obtained all this rent, why didn't it?
This is a typical approach from borrowers who are in distress. A borrower who is in distress, who has a lengthy time period left on a mortgage, will compromise a lease for a cash payment up front, continue to make monthly payments for a period of time, pocket a portion of the cash payment, then leave the lender, as we have, with an empty shell of a building before the expiration of the mortgage and no rental stream to recover the mortgage payments from. That's the reason.
What is the evidence that this was what the landlord was doing, rather than making a commercially reasonable settlement?
There's nothing commercially reasonable.
I mean, is there evidence, or is this just your assertion?
No. There's no evidence that it was commercially reasonable. There's nothing commercially reasonable about forgiving $500,000 owed by a perfectly solvent entity when there's no default. No.
What do you say, perfectly solvent entity? I drove down here from Wisconsin. I passed three Blockbusters that were going out of business.
Remember, it's taken us 4 years to get here. 4 years ago, it was an entirely different situation.
Well, not necessarily.
Well, I don't think they're not in bankruptcy, and there's no evidence to suggest that $480,000 owing from a Blockbuster in 2002 would have been the straw that broke the camel's back. The proper remedy here would have been for the borrower to say, you owe the $480,000. They did communicate to Blockbuster, we need the mortgage holder's consent to shorten the term of this lease. We cannot do this deal. The mortgage lender said, we do not want you to do this deal because we're going to be left with a standalone building that's going to have no value. We want to recover the $480,000 that is owed.
But your problem is, instead of, this is not, what you're saying now isn't in your brief. all you say in your brief is that any settlement with a tenant is rent, and therefore, because of this, you know, not supposed about rent being paid in advance, right? And therefore, it's what the landlord did was in violation of the contract of the mortgage, right?
No, we say something on the. This goes to the.
I don't see anything else in your brief on the merits except the claim that any settlement with a tenant is a settlement that involves collection of future rents.
There's two pieces to the SNDA argument.
Where in your brief?
I don't have the. I can give you the paper.
What do you mean you don't have your brief? You don't have your own brief? All right, forget it.
The SNDA argument has two pieces in the brief. You're right. The advance payment of rent is in there. The second.
Well, I don't agree with that. I don't buy that.
That's the point you were just making about the advance.
Yeah.
The second point that's made in the brief is that on August 7th, we sent a letter to Blockbuster instructing them to pay future rent to the trust pursuant to the fourth paragraph of the SNDA, and they breached that.
Counsel, unfortunately, you sent that after Blockbuster had already paid. And my second question about why things have happened as they did is that when the trustee says, no deal, we don't approve, why didn't the trustee send Blockbuster a pay us directly letter?
We did. On August 7th of 06. They said, and it's in the brief, a pay us directly letter pursuant to the fourth paragraph of the SNDA, and Blockbuster refused. A month later, we filed this suit. We had an independent contractual right under the SNDA to demand future rent payments, and they breached it.
I misunderstood the timing of this. I thought that was the letter that was sent 2 days after Blockbuster paid the lessors.
What Blockbuster did with the tenants irrelevant to the trust because the SNDA says specifically that it cannot be modified or terminated without the consent of the trust. So if Blockbuster makes a decision
you're not answering my question.
No, I am.
You're not.
My
question is why, instead of sending just these no-deal emails, the trustee didn't send a letter at that time saying pay us directly.
The letter was sent after.
You're not answering my question. It is why the trustee didn't send a letter at that time saying pay us directly.
The letters to Blockbuster were sent on the same day. They were both sent on August 6th or August 7th. One day later, actually, Blockbuster finalized the documentation with the tenant. But you cannot read out the third paragraph of the SNDA and permit a termination or modification without our consent and then say we're not entitled to collect future rent because we're going to enforce an impermissible modification of the loan documents.
But that's the question, whether it was unreasonable, whether their settlement with Blockbuster was unreasonable. You want to argue that any settlement that involves a dispute with a tenant is the money in the settlement is a prepayment of future rents, right? That's your basic argument, isn't it?
That's one of the two. That is one of the two. Any settlement is a prepayment of future rents because that's the only obligation that exists, obviously. But the second argument is the inability to modify or terminate the lease to the prejudice of the landlord. Or prejudice of the mortgage holder, and this independent contractual obligation to pay the mortgage holder future rents upon demand. Blockbuster made whatever decision it made with McRae, paid $160,000. That $160,000 is irrelevant to the lender's position. The lender has an independent contractual right to collect. If Blockbuster thinks that it can assert some set-off defense, they can make it. But that won't be binding on the lender because the third paragraph of the SNDA says expressly that the lender is not supposed to be subject to any termination. Here, the SNDA has four paragraphs. Subordinate to the lender, paragraph 2 says that the lender can step into the leaseholder's shoes. Paragraph 3 says you can't amend anything without the lender's consent. And paragraph 4 says at any time, in accordance with the assignment of rents and leases, we can ask Blockbuster to pay rent to us. Here, we sent a letter that said, turn over the rent payment to the extent you claim it's an advance rent payment and pay all future rent to us. Both parties rejected that, and the trial judge erred by concluding that we did not have a contractual right to collect moving forward because the lease had been terminated, but it was terminated impermissibly. They could not terminate without the lender's consent. Everybody in the room agrees, and we did not give the consent. Thank you for your time. Do you have any additional questions? My light's telling me I'm...
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Cross.
Thank you.
Mr. McCray.
Your Honor, if it pleases the Court, I'm Joe McCray. I'm appearing here pro se, but I'm elected to present the position of the Chicago Properties, my wife and myself, on this appeal. I will start with the issue of, unless you want to start with me, the issue of standing, what we call standing.
Real party in interest.
Real party in interest.
Have you by any chance read the Supreme Court's opinion in Sprint Communications?
No, I haven't, Your Honor. And I, it's embarrassing
that I haven't.
The question
in this case, I think it comes down to, is whether the terms of the underlying service agreement make CW Capital an assignee for collection, as the Supreme Court was referring to that in Sprint. And given the fact that there was a very loud dissent by four justices in Sprint, it doesn't seem likely that any departure from that would be acceptable to the justices. So we really need to know how that
contract
stacks up under the governing law.
I spent my career as a trial lawyer. I'm more comfortable relying on what happened at the time of trial and point out something that may answer that question, if you don't mind. At the time of trial, the plaintiff, CW, after not answering the questions at interrogatories, came to trial with a document, which was Exhibit 34 at trial. It's entitled Pooling and Servicing Agreement. What was presented was two pages, the cover page and page 80. There was no signature page and no testimony of any competence as to whether CW was bound to it. So it seems to me the answer to your question, Your Honor, is we don't know because CW is not an authorized.
Is the service agreement not in the record?
It isn't. No, it's not. Only two pages.
Part of it is.
The title page and page 80.
Yeah, well, so what's the problem? I don't understand.
Well, it's not admissible, for one thing.
What difference does it make? Why don't we just substitute the trustee as a party, okay? Would that make you happy?
Would that make me happy?
Yeah, I mean, what's the point, right? I mean, there might be a problem if there was, you know, some problem with diversity of citizenship, but
that doesn't concern
either me. The trustee is the party or the servicer is the party. What difference does it make?
To me as a landlord?
To the case. What
the case, to, because it gives us that.
Is it what?
To the case. It gives us, in the business of, in this case, owning a particular piece of commercial property, the knowledge and the certainty that who's suing me is somebody that I actually owe money to, that when this thing is over, it will be over as to the person I owe money to. We don't know that here.
You're worried that the trustee will sue you because it wasn't named as a party in this case?
Sure. These people.
Well, then you should be arguing that the trustee is the real party in interest.
I am in a sense.
You're not. You're saying that because the wrong person sued you, you should win this case, then the trustee will come after you. But what have you gained? I don't understand all this fussing. What difference does any of this make?
Well, it makes the differences, Your Honor. Once again, I want to go back to the proposition that courts are around to provide clarity and certainty in the law, and particularly in the ownership of property. And this doesn't do that. If you're not willing to come in and tell me that you have the authorization.
So you want to be sued by the trustee? You want this suit dismissed, and then you want to be sued by the trustee? You just said sure.
Sure.
You mean you wouldn't, you have prefer a powerful, you wouldn't prefer to have a decision on the merits saying
I would prefer to have a decision on the merits in my favor. But frankly, Your Honor, I don't think I have. I didn't think I have a choice in this case.
Well, I think you're all wrong. Because, look, these servicers, it's, look, they've got thousands of mortgages, and the servicer is the only one who's authorized to do any of this stuff because of the conflicts of interest among the different mortgagees.
I understand that, Your Honor, but don't you believe, don't we have to show that they, in fact, have that authority? I mean,
they have it. It's right in the agreement.
No, it's
unless
not.
Unless you can argue that the agreement is some sort of fraud because they didn't put in the first seven.
I don't know that it's a fraud or not. It just is not competent evidence.
So great. You're going to have a second lawsuit. I'm sure you will enjoy that.
Well, I'm sure I will have a second lawsuit, and I won't enjoy it. But again, I didn't think I had
a
choice.
You have a good case on the merits, and you want to throw it away so you can get some technical dismissal and be followed by another suit.
Again.
See, that doesn't sound like good judgment to me.
Your Honor, we made a motion in the trial court that the court did not rule on until after the trial. When I tried this case, I didn't know that this would be an issue anymore. But once again, we come back.
You want to say something about the merits?
Yes. I do. I do. Your Honor, Mr. Cross's presentation overlooks the practicality of the situation that was presented to the landlord, myself, at the time.
Well, he makes a very simple argument. He says Blockbuster was solvent. It's still solvent, although staggering. So Blockbuster was solvent, and it owed all this, you know, rent. And you should have gone to the trustee or the servicer and said, well, you know, Blockbuster can pay this rent, but we, you know, we'll be happy to settle with them for less, right?
I did.
That's his argument.
That's it's undisputed. I'm in a trial. In the record, I did go to them. I did say to them, look, these guys are so cavalier about their obligations under the law, they just simply walked away. And this is going to be real trouble. I want some help here. He refused to give it to me. He being McGregor, the agent of the servicer. Never once mentioning to me that he had himself his own requirement for what he would approve, that is a substitute tenant.
So you're saying you would have had to sue Blockbuster?
I did sue Blockbuster.
So that you did sue. So the $161,000, that's the settlement of the suit.
Oh, the lawsuit, yes.
So their argument is what? That you should have, that they wanted to pick up the suit?
No, they wouldn't.
What did they want you to do? Just not settle?
They wanted me not to settle.
Not to settle.
And
did
they
offer to pay your
They didn't offer to assist or help or anything. And they said, you know, you're on your own, but we're not going to approve this. And the final day, my contact was, they wouldn't approve it because he didn't think it was enough, he being Gregor. And I'm stuck. They offered some money. All the news says these guys are going to go belly up. And I've got to move. I've got to make a decision. And I made a decision. And I submit. That's commercial reasonableness. And in the ordinary course of business of managing this place, it was ordinary, certainly, part of the deal. So that's what I did. I didn't have a lot of choice. I didn't see any other way out, and that's the way the trial judge saw it as well. What Mr. Cross fails to point out is they can't sue us for money under these agreements. Unless we've been willful, judge found we weren't, we've been guilty of willful misconduct or have misappropriated rents. As the courts pointed out earlier, this was not rent. It was the settlement of a lawsuit. And we had an opportunity to do it. We took it, and they refused to respond, except in the late last minute. And as the court pointed out, if it's so easy to McGregor, to decide that we're not, I'm not going to approve a settlement unless there's a substitute tenant, and there was no substitute tenant, then why didn't you just do that immediately rather than wait? And he waited more than a week to let anybody know that he wasn't approving it. Any further? Okay. Thank you.
McCray. Mr. Toplinski.
Thank you, Your Honor. Howard Toplinski for Blockbuster, Inc. Mr. Cross, during his argument, said that one thing that everybody in the room agreed upon was that Blockbuster and Mr. McCray were prohibited from entering into this settlement. Nothing could be further from the truth from our perspective and from what we believe to be the plain language of these documents. We were sued on the SNDA. Their argument all along has been the SNDA prohibits a termination of the lease without prior written consent of the lender. It does not. The SNDA merely says that in paragraph 2 and 3 that when the lender eventually, if it ever does, steps into the shoes of the landlord, the lender may not be bound by certain things, a modification or an amendment of the agreement. That is far different from a blanket prohibition prohibiting a termination of the lease, and certainly under these circumstances. And Judge Zagel certainly recognized that. None of those circumstances ever happened. The lender did not step into the shoes of the landlord. And all it says again is they may not be bound by an amendment or a modification. Another reason why, by the way, Your Honor, that this settlement was in fact a settlement and not the payment of rent and why it was commercially reasonable is because the lease itself, Article 22C, prohibits acceleration of the rent in the event of a default. Under Illinois law, Mr. McCray's choice, which Blockbuster surely would have argued when it was sued, was that he could file a lawsuit each and every month to require to obtain that month's rent that hadn't been paid, or he would have had to have waited until actually next month, June of 2010, to file a lawsuit to go ahead and collect his damages. What the parties did was agree instead to an amount that brought him out roughly a year and a half into the unexpired term. And by the way, in 2006, I think that probably we can take some notice of the fact that market conditions were a little bit different, and the risk on Blockbuster at that time was that Mr. McCray would be able to find himself a replacement tenant in 2, 3, 4, even 6 months. He was unable to do so. But that was the risk that Blockbuster took, and Mr. McCray's risk was quite obviously that he wouldn't be able to go ahead and do that. The SNDA didn't create these substantive rights that the plaintiff argues that it created. The purpose of the SNDA is real simple, and that is in the event a mortgage is entered into subsequent to the lease, the mortgage trumps in time, the lease is subordinate, that protects the lender. And number two, in the event that happens, the lease will continue in the event the mortgagee goes ahead and takes over the property. That's the purpose of it. The purpose of it was not, and certainly the language of the agreement, nowhere states that it created these substantive rights between CW Capital and Blockbuster. Judge Easterbrook, your understanding of the chronology is absolutely correct. And Judge Zagel was certainly struck by the fact that in July 18th, I believe, of 2006, Blockbuster's representative had a conversation with CW Capital's representative explaining the deal. He did so at the request of Mr. McCray. The very next day, it was put in front of them in writing. The language of the writing said, here's our deal, and we're going to start documenting this thing. I'm paraphrasing, but we're going to start documenting this thing right now, including a termination of the lease. And nothing happened. We heard from no one. CW Capital knew who to contact. They spoke to a representative of Blockbuster. The first Blockbuster heard of any of this was 2 days after the documents had been tendered, the money had been wire transferred. There was nothing else ever paid. We certainly didn't breach any obligation to pay future rent over notice because nothing else was ever paid. At that point, the horse had left the barn for a reason that Mr. McGregor couldn't explain on the witness stand. Nothing happened, and his litmus test was real simple. Unless there's a replacement tenant, I'm not going to approve the deal. What he could have done is said that to Mr. Stevenson on the telephone on July 18th. He didn't. What he could have done is sent a notice on July 18th when he saw the deal in writing, and he didn't. Nothing happened at all until
they... What would the notice have said? I don't understand.
I'm sorry, what would...
You say he could have sent a notice? What would the notice
have said? Well, he could have said, we object because we believe that under the SNDA this is impermissible. Blockbuster's response might have been, no, it's not.
So are you saying they waived their rights under the agreement?
We say they waived their rights under the agreement. We asserted waiver.
By an action.
We asserted, exactly. We asserted estoppel as an affirmative defense, Your Honor. Under these circumstances, you know, what were we to do? No one communicated with us. What I'd like to do is just
comment on the Rule 17 issue. These servicers of these mortgage-backed securities, they collect the rents, they modify the mortgages, which of course is very sensitive because we modify a mortgage, it affects the different mortgagee's rights. So aren't they really, in effect, the mortgagee?
Yeah, I don't know that they are, in effect, the mortgagee, Your Honor. And
their authority is irrevocable.
That's my understanding.
If you have thousands of mortgages, right, they can't get together and say, we want a different servicer.
Your Honor, Blockbuster, with all due respect, did not advance that argument at trial. Nor do I believe Judge Zagel's opinion entered judgment in Blockbuster's favor as a result of that argument. He, in fact, ruled on the merits in my client's
favor,
I'm quite satisfied with.
The merits.
The other part of this case that was troubling throughout, and certainly I believe was troubling for Judge Zagel, was the question of damages. This case had an unusual procedural history. I think that's one thing that all parties can certainly agree on. But throughout the course of these proceedings, CW Capital's refrain was, by Blockbuster leaving and by the lease terminating, their collateral has been substantially or irrevocably impaired. One would have thought that if that was their theory of damage, then in fact there would have been some evidence as to how the value of the collateral was impaired. What was the value of the collateral prior to the lease termination? What was the value of the collateral after the lease termination, which would have certainly required some expert testimony? None was offered. None was suggested. And as a matter of fact, that theory appeared to have been abandoned entirely at trial. Certainly we believe that the theory of damages that they've advanced, that somehow they're entitled to $470,000 from Blockbuster, after we went ahead and did an arm's length, what we believe commercially reasonable deal with the landlord, paid $160,000 to get out of the lease, we believe that that measure of damages, I'll paraphrase, quote exactly what Judge Zagel said. He said, not exactly, but bordering on fringe lunacy. It just doesn't seem to play any role in this case. Finally, Your Honor.
Did Graves look for a replacement tenant after the termination?
Did Blockbuster?
Not Blockbuster. Did the McRae's look for a replacement tenant?
The evidence at trial was that they attempted each and every month but were unsuccessful in doing so, but continued to pay their monthly obligations even after the 16 months' worth of rent expired, which is another reason why we believe that at trial the theory of damages was missed the mark completely. Unless Your Honors have any questions. Thank you.
Cross, anything further? You have about 30 seconds, I would estimate.
And I'm going to try and get it all in 30 seconds. I'm going to respond to two direct questions. The first, in answer to your question, Judge Easterbrook, if you look at 3.01A of the pooling and servicing agreement, which is in the record, there it says that the master servicer and the special servicer shall service and administer the loans and REO properties that it is obligated to service and administer pursuant to this agreement on behalf of the trustee for the benefit of certificate holders. Full grant. Next paragraph, 3.01B, says that they shall have full power and authority acting or alone to do anything they believe is in the best interest of certificate holders. It's a complete grant to the special servicer. In response to your question, Judge Posner, we briefed at pages 37 and 38 of the brief our entitlement to collect rent upon demand under the SNDA, and at page 35 and 37, why, having given that grant, we should not be bound by the termination which was improperly given. And finally, with respect to my colleague's point that there was some sandbagging because we did not communicate in advance, he had an affirmative obligation to seek advance written consent. We didn't.
Thank you, counsel. I think we would benefit from supplemental memos filed by the parties within 14 days addressing two questions. One is whether the language of this servicing agreement shows that CW Capital is an S&E for collection within the scope of the Supreme Court's decision in Sprint Communications against APCC Services. The second is the question whether, if not, it is permissible to treat the bank as trustee as a party on appeal in order to permit the litigation to be decided on the merits. So memos addressing those two questions due within 14 days. Thank you very much.